You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, June 11th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Let's see, one, two, three, four. We are missing one.
We are short one rogue and one Novella this week. Yep, Bob is doing something. I don't know. He's not available.
The mystery.
Okay, I guess that'll have to do then.
We have a Novella down.
It's like being without a limb. I mean, a less important limb.
Yeah, but still.
No, I'm kidding. No. I'm kidding, Bob. Just kidding. Bob doesn't listen to the show.
That's true. We can say anything we want about Bob because he doesn't listen to the show.
Anything we want?
When I bust Bob's balls about it, he goes, I lived it.
I listen to every episode three times.
Yes, you do. You are well-versed.
Look at your crumbling sanity.
work. Your fragile, delicate hold on
three
existence.
Three times.
Fragile?
Yeah, but they're all, one time's recording it, one time is editing it.
And then I listen back later.
Just to get a sense. Yeah.
Yeah, it's for quality control, you know. Yeah. Someone's got to steer this ship.
I listen to quality control.
So, hey, how long ago do you think the first human blood transfusion happened? Wrong! June 15th, 1667.
No way.
Dr. Jean-Baptiste Denis performed the first human blood transfusion. Though it wasn't human to human. They didn't get human blood. What he did was he bled a boy with leeches 20 times, and then he filled him back up with 12 ounces of sheep blood.
Yikes.
Yeah.
How'd that work out for him?
Actually, not as bad as you think. Probably because it was only 12 ounces.
Yeah.
The boy survived and they didn't record, you know, any kind of horrific reaction.
Wow. Wouldn't his organs go into some kind of failure or something? Like with the blood coursing through his body?
I'm sure he had a negative reaction. I mean, he probably just destroyed it as a foreign body, but it just wasn't enough to kill him, you know?
Yeah. Huh. And the same thing happened with the second patient. He gave more sheep blood to a man a bit later. But then his third patient was a baron who he gave two transfusions. And then on the third transfusion, the guy died. The guy was already quite sick, and that's why he was getting the transfusions. But Denis was put on trial for his death, but he was later acquitted. And it was assumed that the guy's wife had been poisoning him with arsenic or something. So, despite being acquitted, he gave up medicine. And in 1670, blood transfusions were banned in France. And they remained that way until Karl Landsteiner discovered the four blood groups in 1902. And so at that point, they realized why you can't give sheep's blood to a human and expect them to be fine.
Antibodies. And for a while, they were transfusing milk as a blood substitute.
Oh,
did you know that?
Because,
it's milky. What? It's just white versus red.
What?
That's all. Yeah.
Yeah, cow and goat's milk. And then in 1884, saline, basically salt water infusions, replaced milk as a blood substitute. That's good. Doesn't carry oxygen, but it's good to get your volume up.
Yeah.
Saline infusions, that's almost sort of modern. It's amazing how late this all happened. 1901, before, you realize.
Especially considering that this first transfusion was in 1667 and then it took, 230 years for them to eventually figure out the blood group thing.
Yeah, so it was 1628, by the way, that when it was discovered by British physician William Harvey that the blood circulates. Initially, it was thought that they didn't realize the heart pumped the blood through the body. I mean, basic things we take for granted now. There was actually this theory that the blood exploded within the heart and that it was the explosion that sort of propelled the blood
exploded through the body. Like a cylinder in an engine exploded?
Accelerated
it.
But they didn't realize the part was basically a pump.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Dummies.
I mean, you can hear the explosions, when you put the stethoscope to the chest.
As horrific as it is, and you have, people putting blood and other animals' blood into patients or dying people. If these things weren't done, we wouldn't be here. You know,
yeah.
As horrific as it sounds, you know, we have a lot more ethics today in our medical practices and research. And of course, it does probably, in a lot of ways, it slows down progress. But it's
what, ethics?
It's pesky good, yeah, ethics. You know what I'm getting at. Sure. But it's good that people took chances like this in the past, or else, you know, we would still be in a dark ages.
Oh. Well, I mean, seriously, though, we actually, the better ethics today, I don't think it does impede us. I mean, we could have made all these advances doing research on animals, although, of course, the animal rights activists won't agree. But, you know, putting goat's blood into humans probably was not the way to figure out how to do blood transfusions. We could have worked out all the kinks, you know, before subjecting humans to it.
Yeah, I mean, there's also a lot of quote-unquote progress that was made thanks to poor people who – mm-hmm. You know, we're kind of experimenting on against their knowledge, against their consent. So,
or prisoners, you know.
Yeah. Prisoners, yeah.
Yeah, before humans had, you know, basic rights.
And a lot of that was inspired by the Nazis. You know, a lot of the modern medical ethics actually was a reaction to the kind of stuff that was happening in Nazi Germany.
You see, I told you they weren't all bad, Steve.
moving on.
They were so bad it made everything else look halfway decent.
Just the fact that they didn't exist anymore was, you know, a great thing for the world.
So, Jay, you're going to tell us about parents refusing to vaccinate their kids, speaking about medical science.
Yeah, on June 6th of this year, 2013, the Oregon Senate voted on Senate Bill 132 that will require all parents to receive information about vaccines, either from a doctor or an online video, before they can opt out. Before the bill, parents could refuse getting their child immunized. Oh my God, help me, I can't think.
Immunization.
Before the bill, parents could refuse getting their child immunized on religious grounds by signing a form, which was really easy, or based on medical grounds where immunization would be considered dangerous or unnecessary. And I had never heard of that before, and I'd like you to talk on that if you know anything about it, Steve. Like, when would it be dangerous to get vaccinated?
If you're immunocompromised, for example, so if you have, you know, blood cancer, and you won't be able to mount a response. So there are definitely medical reasons why you wouldn't want to immunize somebody. And we don't like to immunize people if they're actively sick and fighting off an infection. You don't want to give them one more challenge.
Right. Okay. So there's legitimate circumstances where someone shouldn't get a vaccine.
Sure.
So after rigorous debate, the bill passed 16-13. And the bill is now heading off for further approval. Over the past 10 years, vaccination exemptions have grown to 6.4% of the Oregon kindergartners, and this is the highest rate in the United States. Real quick, the basic principle of vaccines is to raise the herd immunity of diseases high enough where the disease can't take a foothold in a population. So as an example, even if 100% of people got vaccinated, a small percentage of those people are immune to one or more of the vaccines, meaning that they don't build any kind of resistance to.
They're non-responders. It's probably not, it's misleading to say immune to the vaccine. They're non-responders.
Right. So they don't
for
build,
whatever reason,
they don't build up an immunity to whatever disease the vaccine is trying to help. So under these ideal circumstances where 100% of people get vaccinated, non-immunized people have almost a zero chance of passing the disease. And this is because there's so few people that the chances of them passing it along are that low. But now with the growing tide of people opting out of vaccinations, the herd immunity is below the waterline and diseases are in an upswing, like whooping cough, measles, and chickenpox in particular. But as I was doing my research on this topic, it occurred to me that there's a much bigger question that arises here. And that is, should the federal or local government be able to require certain types of healthcare? Or, you know, we could take it even further than that and say, could they require anything? And the fact is, they do require a lot of things. They do, you know, there are laws that protect citizens from other citizens. And this is a perfect example of that. Senator Doug Whitsitt of Klamath Falls said he personally believes vaccination is the right thing to do, but who are we to tell parents of children that they must vaccinate? Where do we get that right? All right. So my response.
That's ridiculous.
To respond to you, Senator, it's the job of government to make decisions that simultaneously respect the safety and rights of the individual while maintaining the safety and rights of the masses. I'm sorry to point out to you, Senator Whitsitt, that it's hard being in a position of power because you're there to make difficult decisions like these. The only logical thing to do is choose to take the most beneficial route for the most people.
I mean, the argument falls flat on its face. The government demonstrably has the right to take kids away from parents if those parents are guilty of abuse or neglect, not even active abuse, just neglect. So that right of the government to intervene for the benefit of a child if their parents are not fulfilling their minimal duties as parents is well established in law and I think generally accepted. You know, nobody would, I don't think, reasonably argue that parents have the right to abuse or neglect their children. The only real question is not does the government have the right, but is refusal to vaccinate children a form of neglect, of medical neglect and is a justified remedy of that situation mandatory vaccination. Now, in the U.S., there is mandatory vaccination, but only to enter public school.
Yeah.
Which is pretty minimal requirement. I mean, you know, so, like in the U.K., there is no such mandatory vaccination, but in the U.S., and if you want to send your kids to public school, you have to either get vaccinated or you need to get an exemption. And this rule affects those exemptions, like how easy or difficult is it to get an exemption from being vaccinated. This is a bit of a thorny issue, especially in the U.S. where religious freedoms and individual freedoms definitely are highly valued. And there's no question that exemptions reduce herd immunity. They reduce the compliance with vaccines. A successful vaccination program does work better if we don't allow any exemptions. In states that do allow religious exemptions, you know, it should be as difficult as possible. I mean, it shouldn't just be check this box. You don't have to justify in any way why you don't want to vaccinate your kid. Then that's, if it's that easy, just checking a box without having to justify it, then that's not mandatory, right? Then it's mandatory in name only. Here, they're adding this other threshold. You have to receive some sort of instruction about the safety and efficacy of vaccines to make sure that you're making an informed decision on behalf of your children. That seems like a pretty minimalistic requirement also. In other states where that's been implemented, Jay, it's been found to reduce vaccine refusal rates by 25%. So it's not completely efficacious, but it does reduce the vaccine refusal rates. And that's good because, you know, every little bit counts. It gets us towards that herd, you know, that magical herd immunity.
This is like paying taxes. It sucks for some people, probably for most of us, something that we know no one enjoys going to get a vaccination during the moment that it happens, whatever, but it's for the benefit of everyone. We're part of a society.
Well, it's also for the benefit of you. It's not like taxes in that the individual who gets vaccinated benefits. The risk versus benefit is in the favor of the individual. It's not a sacrifice you're making for society or for the community or for the greater good. It's actually beneficial to you to get vaccinated. It also protects others. Yeah. So if you want to, you know, sit in a classroom with 20 other kids, some of whom may not medically be able to get vaccinated, they have a right to be in that classroom too. They have a right not to die from vaccine preventable communicable diseases. And you can't take away that right because you refuse to get vaccinated. If you really feel that strongly about it, then find some other way to get your education. You know, you don't have a right to the public classroom. I think that, it's just like, you know, people, if you want to drive, you got to get a driver's license. If you want to go to a public school, you got to get vaccinated. It's reasonable to have such requirements for receiving some kind of public service or good.
Better if you are able to convince people to come to this conclusion on their own rather than it seem like it's being forced upon
them. The education route is absolutely 100% the best way to go. Teach a man to fish type deal. But in these circumstances right now, Steve, We have people getting sick and we have people dying.
Yeah, but we have, you know, in the U.S., we have very high vaccination compliance. There are pockets, there are communities that are below herd immunity levels because of anti-vaccine propaganda.
Well, speaking of, I think I mentioned this on a previous episode, but Australians should definitely check out the documentary Jabbed that showed up on your TV, a couple of weeks ago. It's it's the perfect way to convince people who are on the fence about vaccines that vaccines are necessary.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Let's move on. Let me tell you a story about an engineer who
Choo Choo Charlie was his name, we hear.
Had a eye surgery to remove a bad lens, a cataract, and had a fake lens put in.
Yeah.
And since the surgery,
he can zoom in and make the noise the Bionic Man made.
No, but he claims
he can see into the future.
He could see in the ultraviolet spectrum.
Oh, wow. Mm. Wait, but would his brain know how to interpret that?
So those are all good questions.
So what is it? Can he also see into the future?
No, he cannot see into the future.
That's
not
a good question.
That's a dumb question. But actually, there are no dumb questions, only dumb people.
Who asks questions?
So yeah, this is one of those stories where I read, it's like, okay, I don't believe it out of the gate. You know, you want to wonder, is this really real or not?
Believe it, right? You were like, yeah,
it's,
okay.
No, it's not impossible. I just want to know what the truth is. It's interesting. Mm. And, you know, a lot of biological questions came up. You know, why would that be? Can our photoreceptors see in the ultraviolet? Why would that be a latent ability? Why would our brain be able to interpret those signals, et cetera? So I looked into it pretty deeply, and after doing the research, my conclusion is that this is real, that this guy is wow. Legitimate.
So what color is it, Steve?
Okay. But what's the,
so you're right, Jay, in that our brains are not wired to see new colors that we've never seen before. It's just that, ultraviolet light will stimulate the color receptors in the retina, the cones, and
so it'll interpret it in some way.
So it gets interpreted in some way, exactly. So some people report just seeing an extension of the violet spectrum still looks violet to them. Other people report seeing like a whitish blue, because whatever, it just depends on how their receptors are being stimulated by the UV light. Now you might wonder why this happened upon removing his cataract and putting in a fake lens. It's because the lens filters out ultraviolet light.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Oh. So when you remove it, the filter is gone, and some brands of the fake lenses don't filter out the UV light, or at least not as much. They allow some UV light through, and then suddenly you can see that light. Your receptors will respond enough to that UV light that it will affect your vision. So being an engineer, Alek Komenetsky is his name, he did a few interesting experiments. He did like a prism and to create a light spectrum, like a rainbow. And he shows like how far to the ultraviolet end of the spectrum he could see. And it's farther than what, you know, you can see. He says most people will see to this line, which is where I see to. I can see all the way over to here. He also had, you know, a friend of his who has a monochromator, which I guess can create a single frequency of light, to show him different, you know, ultraviolet frequencies to see if he could perceive them. And he claims that he can. And things that like you and I would see as black, some things that you and I would see as black, he sees as having sort of a violet, glow or sheen to them. This isn't the only case I found reported. There are other cases of people who, having their lens removed, suddenly see ultraviolet light, including, this is a historical case, Claude Monet.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so he developed cataracts when he got older, and he complained to his friends that colors looked muddy to him. And obviously that was a very tremendous impairment for an artist. And so eventually he was, at the age of 82, he allowed one of the lenses to be removed. And that restored the full color vision to that eye. And also, he started to see colors that he never saw before, and that was reflected in his paintings. There is a painting of water lilies, which normally are just white, that he painted with a bluish hue. That is how somebody might see it if they had a little bit of UV sensitivity.
Hmm. That's awesome.
So yeah, sounds like a pretty convincing historical case. And there have been a number of papers published on it, you know, looking at the fact that yes, the lenses filter out UV light, and yes, our cones can respond a little bit to UV light. So it all is plausible. But neat. This is one of those stories where I wasn't sure if it was true when I first read it. And on investigation, it seems like it actually is true. Now, there are some people, we talked about this before on the show, who have tetrachromacy, who have four different kinds of cones. And you have much more vivid palette of colors that they could see.
Oh, wow. That is awesome.
That's cool.
And
yeah. Closer to birds.
Yeah. Birds have true, you know, tetrachromacy. Yeah. They yeah. see into the ultraviolet spectrum. So in fact, there were bird species that we thought, like the male and the female looked identical because they look identical to humans. But if you add the ultraviolet spectrum, like the males have these bright ultraviolet stripes on them. So to them, they have absolutely no trouble telling the sexes apart, but to us, they look identical.
I want bright ultraviolet stripes.
I know, me too. I want to be able to see that. Would you guys get surgery to see in the ultraviolet spectrum?
I mean, if the surgery were really reliable, I mean, like they could say, all right, we're going to take out your lenses and put in better lenses that one will allow you to friggin' focus again. So I don't have to wear reading glasses. And two, won't filter out the UV light so you could see in the UV. I would consider doing that.
Yeah, I would too.
Nope.
Nah, my eyes are good, so I'm going to leave them the way they are.
Yeah, you got a couple more years, Evan.
Yeah, but you don't want to.
Yeah, I know.
You wouldn't want to be a cyborg, Rebecca?
Eventually, but for now, I like my glasses. And then if I became a cyborg with cyborg eyes, I'd have to be one of those posers that knock the lenses out of my glasses.
Oh, I see. Huh. So it's about being hot to you.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right. You want those hipster glasses.
Cool.
That's it.
Yeah.
Glasses now a third. Are great.
What about a Geordi LaForge, you know, bandana over your eyes?
I always saw Evan wearing that. I could see you rocking that, Evan.
I'm cool with the 80s being over.
Yeah.
Come on, so Rebecca, we'll wear those Geordi LaForge glasses and painter's pants.
All right, now you got me. I'm in.
All right, Evan, tell us about people with ape feet.
I will do just that.
You mean all people?
Well, now. Now, wait a minute. I'm going to tie something else in here for a moment. We've all heard of Bigfoot, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, this particular news story is exactly like a Bigfoot news story because it involves a primate and the prominence of its feet. But there is one distinction, one difference. This one's based in science.
This one's real.
Okay.
Hmm. Yeah. So this one's true.
Seems to be our theme today.
Imagine you're on a day trip to a science museum, and it turns into an experience where you, the visitor, becomes part of a scientific experiment.
Cool.
And it was. For 398 lucky participants.
300!
Almost 400 people at visitors to the Boston Museum of Science, they participated in a scientific study involving their feet. Professor Jeremy De Silva from Boston University asked the museum visitors to walk barefoot, and he observed how they walked. Professor De Silva would have the visitors walk over a special mechanized carpet that was able to analyze several components of their feet. And upon studying the data, it turns out that 1 in 13, or roughly 8% of the participants, have flexible ape-like feet. Our human ancestors would use their bendy feet to wrap around the trunks of trees. It allowed for a better grip. And while the majority of us evolved sturdier, more rigid feet for stability, a fraction of us still have what's called a mid-tarsal break, which bends the foot in the very middle. The results showed differences in foot bone structure similar to those seen in fossils, a member of the human lineage from about 2 million years ago. A human relative called Australopithecus sediba suggests that this distant cousin of ours also had this same mobility in the foot.
Wow.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, they're not really like ape-like, like modern apes. I mean, they don't have the toe going out to the side. They just have this one little flexibility in the middle of the foot. Essentially.
See, now I had the opposite reaction to ape-like, just like a complete so what, because I mean, of course our feet are ape-like. We're apes.
Yeah. But we're hominoid apes.
Just saying. It's not a very descriptive adjective.
So, Evan, can they actually do anything that we can't do as people with normal feet?
Normal? Yeah, they're abnormal.
Us normals. The 92% of us who are normal. Well,
Jay, you have to embrace foot diversity.
They say that with people with this midfoot break have flatter feet. Ultimately, I guess that's kind of the, what does this all mean, right? They walk on a flatter base, but that mid-tarsal break is there. And if you were able to kind of loosen up the ligaments, which have grown rigid and sturdy, you know, along the foot, you could, you know, there could be some bending in the center of the foot where that ridge.
But I think it would be interesting to study the biomechanics of this foot versus the more typical foot is. And, you know, if there are advantages or disadvantages in different situations, like barefoot running or shoed running or swimming or whatever, or climbing. I mean, the notion is that gives you a little bit more flexibility if you're climbing something and you need your feet to grip on.
To grip.
Yeah.
Yep.
How cool. Yep, that is so cool. Feature.
Also, like, is there a way that we can figure out if, like, which kind of feats we have?
Well, Rebecca, let me ask you a question. You're walking through your kitchen and you reach for a banana. Do you reach with your arm or your foot?
I can actually do that. I can pick things up with my feet a lot.
Yeah.
But it's more with my toes. So I don't know if it
counts. That's a toe function. It's not a bend in the center.
Because trust me, I'm very lazy, and so when I drop things, including bananas, I don't bend over.
Yeah, I mean, I've done that, but I'm talking like with articulation. You know, like you ever scratch your face with your foot? You know,
but they do. Right, or, they do
or
have
brush
those,
your teeth. Or
I'm assuming that foot. That pad you use is similar to the one, you know, when you go to running stores and they'll fit you for like your perfect sneaker, and they have a pad that you can walk on that will measure your gait and how you land on your foot and stuff.
A quote from a paleoanthropologist from the Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology, name is Tracy Kivel, said, and I quote, "The research has implications for how we interpret the fossil record and the evolution of these features. It's good to understand the normal variation among humans before we go and figure out what it means in the fossil record."
So I predict that creationists will use that in order to argue that fossil hominids really are not transitional. They're just humans with ape-like feet.
That's right.
Yeah,
yes,
probably.
Absolutely. So this is actually yes. Evidence against evolution.
There
for
you
this
go.
One for the creationists.
Even though it's evidence for evolution, but they'll make it into evidence against evolution.
All right. So I want robotic eye lenses and ape-like feet. That's like a super. I'm halfway to a superhero at that point.
You are. We're building you better.
I don't
better,
know. You're half
faster.
Evolved and half devolved.
No, what I would take over all of those, Jay, I would take a prehensile tail. That would be cool.
Or a third eye.
As long as I could still sit down normally and like lie back, yeah. I don't want to have to sleep on my stomach or anything.
Got
to
tuck it down there, you into your crack, and you'll be all right.
That would be really useful, though. I could totally see that being awesome.
Nobody wants to hear about your crack. Monkey crack.
What mutation would you want to have, Evan? So we got prehensile feet, the ability to see ultraviolet light, a prehensile tail.
You mean my third eye suggestion doesn't count? Because
it's lame.
Three
it's
eyes.
Lame.
I'd want to shoot laser beams out of my eyes to kill my enemies.
Laser beams out of your eyes.
God, we would have to kill you. We'd have to put you down, Rebecca, if you had that power. That's too dangerous.
Or a unicorn horn.
Or how about just full organ redundancy? Second heart, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Why bother with that? Just go with the ability to regenerate.
Regenerate.
And now you're getting crazy.
That way you're not lugging around organs you don't need all the time.
Wolverine. But also, what if, you know, I were to spread my arms and, you know, have these
wings,
you know, flaps of skin, and go gliding around and stuff.
That like a flying squirrel.
Yeah, but you would need something huge. Like, it would be bigger than like a hang glider type wing. It wouldn't be just, you wouldn't be like a flying squirrel type deal.
You would also need like thinner bones and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Rebecca.
Yes.
Was Elizabeth the First actually a madman?
Nope.
A man.
But nope. I read it somewhere that she was a man.
Yeah.
Next.
On the internet.
Is this proof the Virgin Queen was an imposter in drag? Shocking new theory about Elizabeth I unearthed in historic manuscripts. So
it's like you're reading that from the Mail Online
the
or
Daily
something.
Mail. Oh, God. In any other newspaper, that would be the most embarrassing article they'd ever publish. But for the Daily Mail, it was just Friday.
But the Daily Mail, they win a Pulitzer for that one.
So, yeah, it was a long article by Daily Mail standards, too.
Yeah, it was good. It was like it saved me the effort of having to go buy the book.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. So,
thank you.
Yeah, this
saved
entire article 12, is there only because Steve Barry is a writer of like crime historic crime fiction, sort of not historic, but like Dan Brown. He writes, he's a Dan Brown wannabe. you see his books at the airport in that rack and you consider buying them until you see who's on the cover of GQ and you get that instead. So he's writing this book. And so that's why this dumb piece of horse shit is in the newspaper. So what historic manuscripts have been unearthed proving that Elizabeth I was actually a man? Well, none are actually mentioned in the article. So I'm assuming by historic manuscripts that have been unearthed, they're talking about the novel written this year by Steve Barry or the story by Bram Stoker that he wrote in 1910 that was never earthed in the first place. So it can't really be unearthed. He wrote a book called Famous Imposters. It's available in full online and has been for quite some time via, I think, archive.org or whatever.
Bram Stoker of Dracula fame.
Yes, Bram Stoker who wrote Dracula. He wrote this book, Famous Imposters, that was purportedly nonfiction about imposters. And deep into the book, he writes this one story about Elizabeth I based on rumor and conjecture. Bram Stoker appeared to believe it, so why not? Let's take it as fact. Yeah. And the Daily Mail article, actually, if you go and if you read the Daily Mail article, you don't really need to read Bram Stoker's article because they're pretty much like cut and paste. It's the exact same thing.
Oh, good. It saved me more time.
Yeah. So let me break down for you the story. The story is that when Elizabeth I was a 10-year-old child or so, she was sent to the countryside to avoid the plague or any other illnesses. But she ended up getting sick after all, and her caretakers were very concerned. She got very, very ill, and then she died.
They gave her a transfusion from a goat.
They gave her a transfusion. No, that had not been invented yet. So she died and Henry VIII was on his way out to the countryside to visit her. And so her caretakers were terrified that he was going to put them to a grisly death. Like they wouldn't just be hanged. They, you know, their guts would be pulled out and they'd be drawn and quartered. The whole deal. Just a terrifying, horrible death, because that's what happens to people who let royalty die or something.
Yeah.
So they replace Elizabeth with a boy. They can't find any girls in the village that look anything like Elizabeth. So instead, they find this boy who's a distant cousin who is also a redhead, and they dress him up like Elizabeth. They present him to Henry VIII in low lighting, and Henry VIII, being the world's worst father, which I can accept, and also terminally stupid, apparently, says, okay, great. Let's head home. And so for the next 5 decades, the boy continues to pretend to be Elizabeth I through her reign. Mm-hmm. So
that's where Monty Python came up with the idea of that whole mother, father skit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does. It sounds like a funny play or a terrible book. So there are here's the evidence in favor of this argument that she's actually a man. Number one, Elizabeth never married and remained a virgin. Several points here. Number one, so what? Yeah. Number two, she was molested by her stepfather, Thomas Seymour, when she was a teenager, which I think would explain any reticence to marry in her future.
And you think he would have figured it out if it were a boy in drag.
You'd think
like M. Butterfly.
And his molestation of her was made so well known that he was put to death for it. For later plotting to sort of marry her after his wife died. So yeah, there was that. And also, why is it more plausible that a man went for 40 years without having sex than a woman? Like, that doesn't actually solve the mystery of why Elizabeth would not be interested in. And in fact, don't you think that there'd be a lot more going on around the castle? A lot more rumor to keep quiet if, you know, mm-hmm. maids are getting felt up and stuff. Yeah. So it's no, shut up.
But I think the best reason offered is that Elizabeth was just too smart to be a woman.
Yeah, that's number three on my list.
Oh, great.
Number three, she was too smart, too strong. This isn't just like a funny conspiracy theory. This is also deeply sexist.
Absolutely. She was described as not having the mental weakness typical of women.
You know? Right.
Didn't they watch Shakespeare in Love? I mean, she's a woman.
Yeah, right.
Did anyone watch Shakespeare in Love?
Yeah, three times.
I saw it.
Evidence number two, she wore wigs and a lot of makeup. Okay, so, you know.
Didn't everybody?
Yeah, first of all, she's royalty? A queen and yeah, she does what she wants. Second of all, she apparently had smallpox at one point, which contributed to her baldness, like her hair was falling out, not like cue ball bald, but her hair was falling out, her skin was all messed up on her face. And so, yeah, she wore a ton of makeup. You would too, if you were all jacked up. So
very smallpox.
So yeah, the other bit of evidence is that she once told her troops, "I have the heart of a man, not a woman, and I am not afraid of anything."
Up there it
which
is.
Which is, yeah,
smoking
obviously
gun.
She was just doing a tongue-in-cheek. No, it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor based on the exact same sexism that says that a woman can't rule a nation without the help of a man. Like, she can't be smart and she can't be strong enough. There are a lot of other holes in this stupid, stupid story. For starters, no one got put to death for failing to save a sick kid in the 16th century, even if the kid is royalty. Elizabeth wasn't even that special as far as royalty goes.
At the time, she was just, you know, she was not legitimized. She was not the next right. in line for the throne. It's only like in looking back in retrospect that you would, you know, impose this story on her.
And also in the real world, no way would a random 10-year-old boy be able to pretend to be the most famous and the most watched woman in all of Britain while he was going through puberty.
Yeah.
She had maids that would report on her menstruation, to report that she was healthy and that she was capable of, conceiving.
But Bram Stoker, Rebecca, I mean, he wrote Dracula.
That's true. And that was 100% based on a true fact. Story. So
that was based on a legend.
The thing is, it could be like,
it's based on a myth.
It could be a fun conspiracy theory. Like if you like that Da Vinci Code sort of stuff, but let's not pretend that it's real because it really is deeply sexist.
Yeah.
The fact that one of the greatest monarchs that England ever had could not have possibly been a woman. Like, we have to invent this ridiculous backstory to explain how she was actually a man. Come on. BS.
Well, a few weeks ago, we talked to Don McElroy, who is the former chairman of the Texas State Board of Education, and he was the one who presided over the recent kerfuffle about the science textbook standards. Very interesting interview. After the interview, I engaged with him in an email blog sort of discussion to see if we could take it any further. And now that sort of played itself out, I wanted to just report on what I think the bottom line of that discussion was.
Did you convert him?
Did he convert you?
No and no. A little disappointing. I mean, I thought that I was hoping to get him to engage a little more directly with my points, just to see if I could sort of at least back him into a corner. But he just kept reverting to his original points. So what it came down to in terms of his position, and you know, I always find these exchanges instructive. If nothing else, I wrap my head a little bit better around exactly the logic that they're using to defend their position. So Don McElroy's position as to like why the weaknesses of evolution and why he does not feel the evidence for evolution is convincing. He's following this logic. Biology is really complicated. So the evidence for evolution would have to be proportional to the complexity of life, of biology. And it isn't.
By his standards.
Yeah. And by his standard, by his subjective estimation, it isn't proportional to that complexity, therefore the evidence is weak. And then, for example, he says, oh, look at this chart of the biochemical pathways in the body. And there's so many of them. It's this massive chart. We've only figured out a few of them. And of all the, you know, the history of life on Earth that evolutionists claim would be the case, we've only, you know, fleshed out a portion of them. And, you know, we would need thousands and thousands of times more evidence to build a convincing story. So, or look at the complexity of the cell. I mean, you know, the cell is so vastly complex, and yet we don't have a lot of direct evidence for how a modern cell evolved. So there's a couple of massive problems with his position. One is factual, one is logical. The factual problem is that there is a lot more evidence for all the things that he's talking about than he is acknowledging. I confronted him directly on that. He basically is, his method of figuring out how much there is, how much evidence there is to count the evidence offered in popular writings about evolution. And in fact, in our blog exchange, he did that. He said, okay, over the last three or four blog posts and all the comments, there's only 8 pieces of evidence were offered in favor of, like, all the complexity for evolution, which of course is not fair. He also miscounted. I mean, he was counting as one quote unquote piece of evidence, a link that I provided to a review article that literally had over 100 references. You know, I deliberately linked to a review article because it's a reasonable summary of the evidence. And he counted that as one piece of evidence. So in the comments, I used an analogy that everybody seemed to like. So I'll repeat it. I said, that's exactly what Gimli did in the third Lord of the Rings movie when Legolas, you know, jumps on the Oliphant and kills all the warriors on it and takes down the huge beast all by himself. And at the end of this, you know, amazing feat of military prowess, you know, single-handedly taking down that entire creature and all the guardians on it, Gimli says, that still only counts as one.
So argumentum ad dwarfum.
Yeah, so that's it. The Gimli,
Gimli Gambit.
Oh, very good.
So that he pulled that. I think he didn't read the reference, you know.
Or see the movie.
So, there were a couple in there like that. So, but anyway, also, I said that, you know, we had this long discussion about whether or not it's appropriate to use popular writings to estimate the quality and depth of the evidence. And I strongly argued that you can't. I mean, you have to have some familiarity with the technical literature. Like, look, here's a reference with 100 technical articles in it talking about just the evolution of biochemical pathways in prokaryotes. And here's another one that has 100 references in it looking at eukaryotes. Why don't you start there? And then you start counting up the evidence there. And he never gave up that point. He said that it's reasonable to use popular writings to estimate the quality of the evidence. And I proved that he was wrong. I think, you know, I said, I was analyzing your logic. I wasn't setting out to summarize the evidence for evolution, but I said, okay, but here it is. Here's a quick summary, you know, of some of the lines of evidence for evolution and some references to large amounts of evidence. And I did that. And his response was, I don't have time to look through all of your evidence.
Hey, Steve, how much do you think his background as an engineer plays into this particular, stance he has in regards to this particular point?
I don't think it has to do with the fact that he's trained as an engineer or he's a practicing dentist. I think it's that it's motivated reasoning. You know, he has his conclusion, and he's trying to give the, in my opinion, to give the appearance of due diligence without the substance of due diligence. And so, you know, relying upon popular writings, no, it's not adequate. He asked for evidence. I gave it to him, and he basically said, I don't really have time to look through all that evidence.
Yeah.
So
ran away, basically.
But whatever. Maybe you could say, all right, he wasn't willing to sort of confront that head on, but I planted the seed. Maybe he'll look through it at some point. Who knows? And it's just massive. I mean, the amount of evidence is just massive. But there is a deeper problem with his argument. Not only is it factually incorrect, he's grossly underestimating the volume of evidence for various lines of evidence for evolution. He's looking at the evidence in the wrong way. He's saying that the amount of evidence has to be proportional to the complexity of life on Earth and the alleged history of life on Earth. Rather than saying, looking at evolutionary theory is in terms of how well has it made predictions about the evidence that we have. But that's a much better way of judging whether or not evolutionary theory and the different components of evolutionary theory, such as common descent, for example, whether or not that's likely to be true. It's how useful is it as a theory and how well does it make predictions about future evidence? I and many other people have convincingly argued that it remarkably well, thank you. You know, the evolutionary theory has been stunningly, stunningly successful in predicting the future evidence. I gave as one of my favorite examples, bird evolution. So in Darwin's time, that was a massive gap in the record, right? So we had birds as a kind, right? Birds as a group of life. Probably their closest related other group is reptile. So that, you know, at the time you could argue about whether, you know, what group within reptiles would be most closely related to birds. Evolution didn't demand that birds evolved from dinosaurs, but if evolution and common descent were true, then we absolutely would need to find connections between birds and some group of reptiles. If evolution were not true or common descent were not true, that would not be necessary. And what would the odds be that we would find that? I mean, it's hard to really calculate those odds, but I think people take for granted the exquisitely evolutionary pattern of the fossil record that we find. I think it's so much taken for granted that people don't realize how powerful it is as evidence for evolution, the power of the predictive value of evolutionary theory and common descent. So in the last 150 years, we found primitive birds, essentially small dinosaurs with feathers, feathered dinosaurs, this entire adaptive radiation of feathered dinosaurs, of primitive birds, of primitive feathers, in a proper temporal sequence and a reasonable geographic sequence. So not just randomly scattered around time and geography. They're in locations and in times. That's an exquisitely evolutionary pattern that something like that was required if evolution were true, but not if evolution were not true. The probability of finding that pattern of fossils in the record just by random chance alone, I think is minuscule. It's so small that it pretty much rules out any other alternate hypothesis
except for planted by Satan.
Well, unless you have some contrived theory that basically says that the evidence looks as if it were evolution. And you contrive that in some way. But then Occam's razor deals with those, with those alternatives. Evolution and common descent is certainly the simplest, most elegant explanation for why the fossil record is what it is. And then you take the evidence for the evolution of birds, multiply that by a couple thousand, and that's what we're really talking about, you know, in terms of all the evidence for everything. I mean, pretty much name any major group, and we have a pretty good fossil record of a temporal sequence. There are still some gaps, you know, like bats, there's a pretty big gap between mammals and bats, but, for example, but for many, many, many things, we have, you know, picket, pigs, you know, dragonflies, whatever, there's evidence for a reasonable sequence, you know, at least making, you know, filling in the connections that we would expect to be there.
You know, and I think Don's kind of clever in that he really doesn't deny that evidence. He just says it doesn't add up. There's not enough of it.
Yeah, but that's a denialist strategy. You can always say that's not enough. It's easy. It's cheap. It's not really a meaningful scientific or logical analysis.
It's like a form of moving the goalpost. I think.
It is, absolutely. It absolutely is moving the goalpost, but it's just denialism. It's just, that's not enough evidence. I want more evidence. Well, how much? How are you deciding how much evidence is enough? I mean, it's just, and again, it's looking at it the wrong way. That was, I think, one of the key insights that I got out of the exchange. So if anyone who's interested, I suggest you go to Neurological Blog, read the entire exchange. There were five total blog posts, including responses from Don McElroy. And very revealing in terms of the motivated reasoning and the denialism on display.
When he wrote to you as part of his last exchange with you, he said the following: "Of course, our major disagreement is that I am a theist and you are an atheist. I wonder how much that colors our view of the sufficiency of the evidence for evolution." What did you feel about that when he wrote that?
That is a typical false equivalency argument. That is typical of the creationist, is to say, okay, oh, evolution and creation are just different ways of viewing the world and different ways of viewing the evidence, and they're as biased as we are, you know. So it is in a way, I think, emblematic of how weak a position creationism is in today compared to, you know, 100, 150 years ago when they were actually trying to dethrone evolution or prevent it from being taught at all. Now they're sort of content to say, all right, creationism isn't science. Creationism, you know, is just a belief system. But so is evolution, you know, trying to drag evolution down to the level of creation with these false equivalency arguments. But of course, they're not valid because evolution is an actual science that makes predictions and could have been falsified and has multiple independent lines of evidence in support of it. And creationism isn't even a scientific theory. So there's no equivalency there whatsoever. All right. Well, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
I'll play for you last week's Who's That Noisy as a reminder, and we'll talk a little bit about it. So here we go.
We found that she could feel the vibration of spoken words.
That was the voice of Anne Sullivan, right? Best known for being the instructor and companion of Helen Keller.
Yep.
Helen Keller, of course, is a very famous figure, American author, political activist, lecturer. She was the first deaf-blind person to earn a Bachelor of Arts degree. And her story, if you've seen any versions of it, either on television or Broadway play, Miracle Worker, explains the story of Anne Sullivan's being able to help Helen Keller come out of a life of being incapable of speaking or understanding things. And she, and with her own disabilities, because Anne Sullivan herself was blind, was able to show her, basically teach her what things looked like, sounded like, and felt like in the world, and really uncovered this really sort of brilliant person that was underneath, unfortunately, this broken body.
So who's our lucky winner this week?
This week's winner goes by the name of iPuppy.
iPuppy.
iPuppy. I call you iPuppy.
iPuppy. Isn't that cute? Like, you know, an Apple product or something. But in any case, iPuppy, you're the winner this week. You are now in the final drawing at the end of the year. We're going to draw the winners for the year, and that final grand prize winner will join us for a round of science or fiction.
And what do you got for this week?
All right. For this week, another classic Who's That Noisy, which I'm going to play for you right now.
I won't stand here and watch you murder your patients just because you can't be bothered to read the latest science.
All right. You can join our forums at sguforums.com and leave us your response there. Or you can send us an email, WTN, which stands for Who's That Noisy? WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And I wish you all the finest, greatest, most wonderful amount of luck ever bestowed on any human
history. Oh, my God.
What are you
gonna throw a cherry on top of that?
Good luck, everyone.
And make sure the address is .org, not .com. We had someone email me today complaining that the email didn't go through.
It was a user error, huh? All right, thanks, Ev. One email this week. This one comes from Neil from Canada. Very imprecise, but Neil from Canada writes, Seattle woman attempts to live on sunlight water. Thought you guys might find this interesting. It will be interesting if she admits failure or fakes it. And he links to a news item detailing the shenanigans of a woman who is attempting to live entirely on sunshine.
Breatharian.
A breatharian, yeah. So this is following the advice of the website livingonlight.co.
Proof that we'll never be able to get rid of all pseudoscience and irrationality, because breatharians can continue somehow to spread their quote-unquote philosophy. The stupidest, most dangerous...
Did you read the website?
Deadly thing. And they continue to do it.
Her name is Navenna Shine. I wonder if the shine is a pseudonym.
Yeah.
The website tells you, go outside, you know, right before sunset, and, you know, you increment the amount of time that you stare into the sun. So you got to start, like, doing it for 10 seconds, and you add 10 seconds every day, and you keep looking at it. And then, you know, it's just like these ritualistic things that they ask you to do until you build up. It's kind of, you know, I just read it like, you know, you're just building up this internal battery.
Yeah.
And then eventually you won't have to eat. You know, every time I read stuff like this, it's like, give me the person and give me 3 days and we'll figure out, you know, who's hungry and who's not.
These are the people that Randy had to stop testing for the $1 million because somebody was going to die at some point.
Yeah.
It was so obvious nonsense, such obvious nonsense. They were either going to cheat or they were going to kill themselves, and he didn't want that on his conscience.
Didn't he catch one of them sneaking out to get Burger King?
Yeah.
And, said, he confronted him on the way back to the hotel.
And
the guy said, got
was,
there?
The guy said he was just going to breathe in the vapors.
Yeah.
So apparently Shine has already lost 20 pounds since she started her experiment. Now, the difference here is that she is videotaping herself to prove that she's not cheating.
Yeah, because
it's so well, that's, okay.
That she's not cheating anytime she's in front of a camera.
That's what Neil was referring to when he said, it'll be interesting to see if she admits failure or fakes it. She seems sincere, but that doesn't mean anything. Just, you know, means she's gullible. And she, so the reading the justification for this, this philosophy is, again, it screams scientific illiteracy. First, the notion that the sun energy is getting in through your retina somehow to your brain. Okay, that's seeing, first of all.
Yeah.
And, you know, but what they, again, they have this vague concept of energy. There's just energy is getting into your body somehow. Staring into the setting sun is, first of all, is an irrelevant effect on how much, you know, solar energy is impinging your body. Or light is, you know, getting into your brain. It's just, it's silly. And also, they claim that, you know, we eat food for energy. So just cut out the middleman and get the energy directly from the sun. Ignoring the fact that we also eat food for nutrients, not just for energy, but for vitamins and minerals, you know, so-called micronutrients that are necessary for the biochemistry of our body to function. So it's not just for energy. Even plants don't rely 100% on sunshine. They also need water and they need carbon to fix carbon dioxide from the air and they need to get nutrients from the soil. So maybe she should eat fertilizer, you know, breathe carbon dioxide.
You're telling her to eat shit and die? That's
basically well, hang on.
But why would we have to learn to absorb sunshine?
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't understand why they think, like, why is there some type of process of learning how to do this?
Well, she thinks that, like, once her body is starved enough, it's just going to magically find another way to get energy.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to invent chlorophyll and just start producing chlorophyll, I guess, is what she thinks.
Yeah, did you see that quote where she said, I have the feeling that my body has reached a point where it's used up all the stored fats. It's now looking around for what next to consume.
Yeah, your body. That's
it's
what
just,
it will
it's
consume.
Just opening up all the cupboards, looking for the nutrients. Sure, it'll find them eventually.
Right, but it will be interesting to see what she does when, you know, she is starving to death. At what point is she going to say, okay, I think I'm going to eat now?
There are people who have died from this.
Or is she going to try to fake it? Is she going to try to hide it? Or is she going to be one? I mean, according to SeattleGlobalist.com, 4 people have died doing this, trying to live just on sunlight. I don't know if that's accurate, but you know, she could become that another breatharian statistic.
You need water much more than you need food.
Yeah, she is drinking water today, but that's just to flush the toxins out of her body, though.
But the idea is, you know, after not eating for a while, like, there's a lot of bad things that happen. Like, I think in a number of days, you would feel so disoriented.
Yeah.
So wrong. I mean, you know, I'm restricting calories right now just to lose some weight for the summer. You know, it's like my yearly maintenance. I always do it this time of year. And like, I'm like cutting out like a very, you know, moderate percentage of my calories and I am utterly miserable.
You're just a wimp though.
How does your body not sort of take over at a certain point and override what your will is, you know, and really seek out the food and just you kind of subconsciously go and put something into your mouth?
Yeah, the desire to eat must get pretty overwhelming.
And then you can't just binge after not eating for a while, too. You have to re-acclimate yourself to eating. It's a very scary and, you know, medically dangerous thing to do to yourself.
You think she's hooking herself up to an IV or something off the camera?
It would be easier just to eat off camera if she's going off camera, right?
Yeah.
It would be easier to eat. But
if she's being sincere about the whole thing, which we think that she might really be, then maybe she's doing something like that, not counting it as eating,
yeah,
calling it a fluid or something and, you know, justifying it that way.
How long has she lasted so far?
32 days and lost 20 pounds.
So it's 32 days and she's claiming she hasn't passed one calorie in, right?
Just water.
I think she's lying.
I guess do your bowels shut down at some point?
Yeah. You're done. Evan, your digestive tract shuts down. Like,
I remember reading a blog from a breatharian years ago.
It's so hungry.
It was pretty funny, actually. It was more, so he was describing that this is his lifestyle, that he doesn't need food to live, he just needs sunlight. But he said, in order to maintain good social relations with the people around him and his family, he was expected to go out and eat and have dinner with his family and stuff, and they would ask questions or harangue him if he didn't at least eat a little bit. So he was doing that, but in his head, he was living entirely off of sunlight, and those times that he was eating were just few and far between. But I got the feeling that that was actually like every night of the week he was eating. But sort of, you know, just because he believed in it so much, you know, he definitely believed that he was living off of sunlight. He just sort of forgot all those times he was actually eating food.
That's like the yogic flyers who are jumping really high and thinking they're levitating.
Yeah. And they do it on mattresses where there's more bounce. Hey, to all you breatharians out there, do not move to Seattle because you're going to die.
Yeah. Somebody pointed that out. Seattle's not a great place to live off of sunshine. All right. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week, because I know you guys love themes. This is about compliance, people doing what they're supposed to do.
Okay.
You'll understand when I read them.
Compliance. Okay.
Yeah. Item number one. A new study finds that only 5% of people properly wash their hands after using the bathroom. Item number two, researchers find that 35% of designated drivers still drank alcohol, most to the point of impairing their driving. And item number three, despite being mandatory in some hospitals, less than 50% of healthcare workers received a flu vaccine in 2012.
Oh boy.
All right, Evan, go first.
Why, these are all very disturbing. Each in their own way, right? I mean, yeesh, it's even hard to read these. 5% of people properly wash their hands after using the bathroom. Properly wash their hands. So imagine by properly meaning soap and warm or hot water as opposed to cold water, no soap. And long enough, certainly with the soap, you have to sing happy birthday or something like that without paying the drop fee for doing so. to the happy birthday Nazis out there. 5% of people.
Jawohl.
I don't know. 5% is awfully small. Awfully small. Something's not right there. 35% of designated drivers still drank alcohol. Most to the point of impairing their driving. Wow. I believe the 35% drank the alcohol, but I would have thought it might have been like, you know, half a beer or something, something that doesn't get their blood alcohol level up to illegal limits. And the last one, less than 50% of healthcare workers received the flu vaccine. Wow, that's really unfortunate if that one's true. I can see there being a big part of the population non-compliant in a sense with the flu vaccine, although, well, I'm going to say that I think it's the 5% of people properly washing their hands. I think maybe at a time it was as low as 5%, but with recent, maybe in the last generation or so, more education about instructing people how to wash hands. There's commercials on television now in promoting kids, make sure you wash your hands. You know, I know they do a lot of it at school because Rachel brings home pieces of paper with reminders for kids to wash their hands and stuff. So I think that one's too low. I'll say the washing hands one is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Okay, that's funny because when you first asked the questions, I was 100% definitely going to say that 5% of people washing their hands is fiction because it's disgusting. But Evan actually talked me out of it because of the word properly. You mentioned the whole like singing happy birthday thing. I heard the ABCs, but same difference. Yeah, now I can believe it. Like at first, when he first asked it, my head was like only 5% of people wash their hands after using the bathroom, which isn't, which would be horrific and hopefully wrong. I feel like I would notice if only 5% of people, like when you're in a public restroom, you know, you occasionally see that one person walk out of the stall and right out the door, and you're like, what the F? But it doesn't happen as often as 95%. But the properly thing, yeah, I can believe that 5%, only 5% actually do wash their hands for long enough, and yeah, I believe that. I can also believe that 35% of designated drivers still drank alcohol because people are stupid murderers. I can totally buy that, because people don't realize they think they can have a beer or two, and it doesn't occur to them that that is the whole point of being a designated driver. I can believe that. 50% of healthcare workers receiving, saying less than 50% of healthcare workers received their flu vaccine in 2012. That to me is suspect only because I thought that it was mandatory for the most part, for most healthcare workers, like in hospitals and stuff. I don't know about doctor's offices, but yeah, I thought it was a mandatory thing. And if that's the case, then it should be much, much higher than 50%. So I'm going to say that that one's the fiction.
And Jay.
Okay. The one about 5% of people properly washing their hands after using the bathroom. I totally agree with that. What people are doing is not washing their hands long enough. It's really easy to not keep your hands under the water and in the suds long enough. I think, you know, it's just very common. I see people at work that barely wet their hands with the water, not even use soap. So that one is science as far as I'm concerned. Researchers find that 35% of the designated drivers are drunk or, you know, not completely sober. Yeah, I could see what Rebecca's saying too. I mean, I could see the designated drivers, a portion of them are having one drink. Like, all right, let's have a drink early and then I'll be fine by the time we leave type of deal. But this last one about 50% of hospital workers, even in a mandatory situation, are not getting the flu vaccine. That God, is that true? Could that possibly be true? 50%. I'd think it'd be more like 5% don't get it. I mean, they're there. They see the people. They see the sickness. And then what would the reason be? If laziness? I don't know. 50%. And then it's such a high percentage. This is the reason why I think this one might be it, because it's such a phenomenally high percentage. This is either like really it or really not it. All right, I'll take the one about the designated drivers, just so there's an even spread here.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, I like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Only one.
That is an even spread. So I guess I'll take this in order. A new study finds that only 5% of people properly wash their hands after using the bathroom. Evan thinks this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
Gross.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
And yeah, Rebecca got it. It is the properly.
Well, Evan got it.
Evan spelled it out, but Rebecca saw the significance of that. And it is, you described it very well, Evan, using soap and doing it for a long enough period of time was what was considered properly. 15 to 20 seconds. So only 5% of people use soap and wash their hands for 15 to 20 seconds.
Hmm.
That's what the CDC says is necessary to effectively kill germs. The average person washed their hands for only 6 seconds. 15% of men didn't wash their hands at all, compared to 7% of women.
Oh, man.
When they did wash their hands, only 50% of men used soap, compared to 78% of women. People were less likely to wash their hands if the sink was dirty. Hand washing was more prevalent earlier in the day. So as people get later and later in the day, they get lazier about washing
their
hands.
Yeah, so now, like, the rest of us flubs have to touch that frickin' doorknob.
Yeah.
Like, why don't they make it so all you have to do is kick the door?
They do.
Everything needs to be hands-free.
Haven't you seen those doors? A lot of bars have them now. That's like there's a little metal thing at the bottom of the door you can just hook your foot under and open it up.
Or use your butt and back into it. Or take the paper towel that you dried your hands with and use that to grab the handle with.
But people were more likely to wash their hands if a sign encouraging them to do so was present. You know what I bet would be even more effective than a sign saying wash your hands?
An attendant staring at you?
An attendant, or just a picture of a pair of eyes would probably be more effective. There is research looking at that. People are more compliant with stuff and more honest when there's just a picture of eyes posted. So
that's bizarre.
They have to put the Purell type stuff up in the bathrooms. That's more effective.
Cause for killing the germs, doesn't remove the dirt though.
Take a little, squirt and you know, rub it into your hands. You got to rub it off. You know, you got to rub it till it evaporates.
I never feel clean after using that.
That's right. I don't either. I need to remove a layer of skin, right, yeah, in order to feel kind of clean.
Yeah, I don't like that stuff either.
It's great, though.
It's handy. No pun intended. Yeah. Pun intended.
Isn't it?
In a pinch
making
or something,
but. Super bacteria, though.
No. No, it's not like, it's not like an antibiotic. It's just antiseptic. It just kills the bacteria. So no, it's not, the Purell stuff is not leading to bacterial resistance. Having like antibacterial soap, maybe, but not like Purell, not the alcohol. That's more effective. It's easier. Compliance is higher. You could do it much quicker. Just, all right. Well, let's go on to number two. Researchers find that 35% of designated drivers still drank alcohol, most to the point of impairing their driving. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Oh, man.
Hooray, see? But also right, boo for society.
Yeah.
So definitely. In a study that was recently performed, a University of Florida study, they found that 35% of designated drivers had significant alcohol levels greater than 0.02, which in some countries is actually the legal limit. In the United States, the legal limit is 0.08. But generally speaking, the recommended level in terms of like not being impaired is less than 0.05. And, according to the AMA, they recommend 0.05. And, some countries use a 0.02 cutoff. So in this study, the 35% were at 0.02 or greater. Half of those were at 0.05 or greater.
20% of those were at 0.18. Toasted out of their mind.
Yeah, like you are the worst designated driver on the planet.
Yeah.
Like you, yeah. What do you think that means, designated driver? Like you were picked because you drive the best when you're drunk? Like,
right.
Is that what you thought it was? Oh, I hate people. I hate people so much sometimes.
So the researchers recommend that if you're the designated driver, you shouldn't drink at all.
Yeah. No but shit.
What a concept.
People do grossly underestimate the effect that alcohol has on their blood alcohol level. They don't realize how fast your level gets up to an impaired level.
Yeah. That's because they can take it. They're not like other people. They're,
right.
I know my limits.
They can hold their drink.
Just one more. And another thing.
This all means that despite being mandatory in some hospitals, less than 50% of healthcare workers received the flu vaccine in 2012. That one is the fiction.
Yeah.
So here's the information. It does depend on whether or not getting the flu vaccine is mandatory or not. Overall, so the CDC reports that the overall rate of flu vaccine uptake among healthcare workers in the 2011 to 2012 season was, what do you think?
85-90%.
65%. 65%, I guess.
But in...
Cool, it was right on.
In hospitals where it was mandatory, it was like 98.7%.
How is it not mandatory everywhere?
Like, yeah, well, that's the trend now. That's the trend, just to make it mandatory. And this was based upon recent research which found that in those hospitals or those systems where they make it mandatory, it resulted in very, very few employees basically deciding to quit rather than get vaccinated. Most of the vaccine refusers were part-time workers. Most of them eventually relented and got vaccinated, and very few, a tiny percentage, like 0.002%, decided to quit because of the mandatory vaccination. So it's not a problem, basically. Wow. For the employer, but it does raise the compliance rate way up to like 98-99%. So this is interesting based upon our recent discussion, but for healthcare workers, the responsibility to get vaccinated is even greater than just the general population.
Yeah, because they're working around immunocompromised people on a regular basis. Like you could kill somebody.
There's a professional responsibility in addition to just being a good citizen.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So how do you take your Steve? What do? They give you the traditional needle, the gun. What are they?
Just a needle. It's a tiny, tiny little needle. It's so thin and you barely feel it. Just take the needle in the arm. You can get the nasal one, but the arm.
Yeah, it was
nasal.
Just a little cut.
Aerosol.
It's just a little cut. Yeah, but it's a live virus, the nasal one, so not everybody can get it, and it's not as effective. So you're better off just getting the.
I just go to CVS.
Take the shot.
So Steve, we have this.
Doesn't even hurt.
The Skeptical Caveman production.
Yeah. Happening. How's pre-production coming on that, Jay?
It's going really well. I mean, I'm working night and day on this. And, I just sent out an email to the people that emailed me volunteering. And it's not too late to volunteer. If you, are local enough to come and want to be at the shoot and help us, you could do that very easily. Just send us an email with the subject line OCK, and you could send that to info@theskepticsguide.org, and I'm going to respond to you and we'll chit chat and I'll find something for you to do. You know, I also have some people donating time to build props, and I have, you know, people filling all the spaces up pretty quickly, but I definitely would still enjoy having some more people join us, and we're still looking for some actors as well. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email. And also, if you want to help the production and you can't by coming in person, you can still donate and also just send us an email. Also, Steve.
Yeah.
I have a phenomenal quote.
Let's hear it.
But first, last week I forgot to yell the name.
You did.
And doesn't that make you upset?
It was, yes. It was conspicuously absent.
We got all those angry emails from people.
It was almost unbearable.
It was a little experiment. Zero people noticed that you didn't yell.
I know. So, I mean, if people don't like it.
Jay,
I mean,
noticed.
You know, if people don't want me to do this. Like, I'm doing this to inspire people. And if there's no inspiration happening, yeah. I'll just stop. I could just
stop. It's perspiration.
Yeah, I could just stop doing it.
That's spittle, I think.
You know, so I was going to yell out the name of last week's quote, the author of the quote last week. I won't unless people email me and just to let me know, hey, you know.
Beg you to continue.
No, I just want to know if anyone's actually listening. You ever see WKRP in Cincinnati, and it was like the guy had like the late shift on the radio station. This was like an old TV show. And he goes, all right, I'll tell you what. He's on the air, and he goes, I'll give $10 to the first person that calls in, and nobody calls in. So this week's quote is a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the quote is, the function of education is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. Intelligence plus character. That is the goal of true education. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I like the first part of that quote better than the second part. I mean, it's all fine, but yeah. I think thinking critically, I think we can all agree with that. Mm-hmm. When the public school system decides that it's their job to teach sort of character and morality to students, it starts to feel sometimes a little bit dangerously close to propaganda. You know, it's usually fine. Like, sometimes my daughters come home with stuff. It's like, just has this little flavor of 1984 to it, you know?
Like what?
I know what you're saying.
Oh, it's like, you know, yeah, it's like recycling stuff, you know, too. And recycling, okay, it's fine, but there's not a lot of evidence to support a lot of recycling that happens, but it's sort of sometimes it creeps over the edge into feel good propaganda.
I guess DARE. I just remember DARE. That was a pretty horrible propaganda sort of thing that I got.
I don't know.
What was that?
Did you not get that when you guys were in school?
It sounds familiar, but
it's
I can't remember.
Anti-drug stuff where it's
anti-drug,
like,
yeah.
You know, if your dad smokes a joint, you got to turn him into the authorities.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Have you guys seen those billboards? If you see something, say something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. No, yeah. I like the anti-bully one. Is that what you're talking about?
No, this
no,
is
no,
like
no.
a
this
terrorism.
Is the one where you
thing.
See a knapsack on a bus or something, you're supposed to tell someone.
Oh, okay.
About
yeah.
It,
well, you know, after people die from random explosions, I can see backlash.
No, it is common sense, but you just get this. I don't know. Just, I was,
yeah, the
know.
Added
people are dying from explosions from backpacks. I mean, it's not many.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah, you're going to turn kids into narcs. Just, and how effective is that going to be? Yeah.
Well, in defense of the quote, I think he's saying that education builds character.
Well,
that is a charitable way to look at it.
I think so.
And this quote was sent in by a listener named Meiji. Thank you.
Meiji.
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 Meiji. Magi.
All right. Thanks, Jay. And just a quick reminder that there is still time to sign up for the amazing meeting, July 11th to 14th in Las Vegas, Nevada. This is a huge, awesome skeptical meeting. The SGU will be there. We will be giving workshops. We'll be doing a live show on stage. There'll be an SGU dinner Friday night, an SGU-sponsored poker tournament Saturday night. We'll have a table. We will be there to listen to and chat with our listeners. The speakers this year are fairly impressive. We have Susan Blackmore, Barbara Drescher, Jerry Coyne, Sanal Etemoorukwu, remember from Kili Kili fame. Two Massimos. You get two Massimos for the price of one, Pigliucci and Polidoro, and many others. It's going to be an awesome conference this year. I hope to see a lot of our listeners there. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, and good night, Steve.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.